Great to be back with you for another GoldSeek.com Radio Gold Nugget segment. Today's special guest, Harry S. Dent Jr. Well, Harry S. Dent Jr. is head of an economic research and forecasting company and author of The Demographic Cliff. Welcome back, Harry S. Dent Jr.
Nice to be back, Chris.
You know, I'd like to begin the discussion today with a lot of interesting geopolitical issues facing the globe. One of the things that come to mind, I think, obviously, is the Russia-Ukraine drama. Initially, this didn't catch, I think, the mainline media as particularly concerning, but that's changing. I'd like your thoughts on how this could impact the markets and the global economy.
Well, you know, first, Chris, back in early 2006, I added a cycle to my demographic and other cycles, which I call the geopolitical cycle. The markets tend to be favorable geopolitically for about 18 years and then unfavorable. And since 9/11, we've had just one geopolitical disaster after the next. You know, the Iran-Iraq wars and Syria civil war and the Arab Spring. And now it is focused on Russia and Ukraine and, of course, Israel and Gaza. This is a cycle that continues to point down for the next 5 or 6 years. So we're only going to see more of this, and I do not think any of these problems are over. And the markets tend to be valued at about half, the price-earnings ratios when this cycle is down. So I hear a lot of pundits saying, oh, the markets are not that overvalued at 70 times earnings. No, it's extremely overvalued given these geopolitical risks, and there's no end to any of these from what we see.
You know, it's interesting you should point that out. How much further could the equities rally really go? 10%, 20%? At some point, there has to be an aha moment where people recognize the fact that we've been running on fumes for so long that there has to be a reckoning day. You did mention the Middle East, and I think this is also, it's a hot button issue. It could escalate out of control. I mean, we have in Iraq. I mean, that's obviously going to be a problem. And then, as you mentioned, you know, Gaza has been trouble, and it's just getting worse. How do we factor this in, you know, into our function? How do we prepare as investors for what could be, you know, an Archduke Ferdinand-style moment down the road leading to a global issue? Is there something that investors can do, precautions we can take, contingencies that can be made?
Again, I think you're right. The market has, I say, more like 5% upside potential and 65% in the next few years on the downside. So it's a huge imbalance. And it means investors should just be cautious. They should be pulling out of stocks on every rally. Geopolitical events are a risk, but the bigger risk is from demographic factors. Demographics continue to point down much more strongly in the U.S. starting in 2015 and starting this year in countries like Germany and Europe, it gets worse. So basically, we don't see anything pointing up. Demographic factors point down, geopolitical. I even have recently added in my newsletter what I call a 45-year innovation cycle. I mean, like steamships just like peaked in their momentum in 1875 and then fell off, and then railroads in 1920 and automobiles in 1965 were finally 80% of households had one, and now the internet. So every cycle we look at says, look out. Yes, we've been in a long boom since 1983. It's been goosed by artificial stimulus, which never lasts and is never real. And, yeah, we have a lot more downside than upside. So investors should not be listening to the pundits who say, oh, yeah, the stock market's okay and the Fed's got our back on the economy. The Fed has stretched things way beyond what anybody would have thought, and it only creates more downside. They're only putting off, like you said, the inevitable kind of reset or reckoning that has to come from the greatest debt and financial bubble in modern history.
Let's talk about demographics for a moment, but not from our traditional discussions here with you on the show, but let's add another component. You know, the late and very interesting Michael Rupert met an untimely demise. He had, I think, an interesting take on demographics. He liked to look at it in the context, okay, of peak oil. You know, I think it's interesting that this really does seem to work well with your thesis, demographic trends, because his concern was with finite amount of oil, which of course is supposedly declining due to peak oil, that could not work well in any way, and I'm putting it euphemistically, with demographics. Eventually, you reach this breaking point where there just isn't enough of this natural resource to sustain the lifestyle that the Western world has come to love and to export that lifestyle to China and many other peripheral nations. I'd like your thoughts.
We see oil prices heading down. Commodity prices peak about every 30 years, 1950, 1980. And they peaked back in mid-2008. They rallied into 2011, and they're still heading more down, and I think oil is heading down. So oil is a factor, and it is a limitation, but I think the weakness in the global economy is going to weaken oil prices, and we have become less dependent on oil because of fracking, which has its ups and downsides, but you know, it. I don't see that as the biggest impediment going forward. It has been a big one in the past. But I tell people I don't want to be investing in the oil producing nations in the Middle East, because not only do they have huge geopolitical problems, you know, basically civil wars everywhere, but they have falling oil prices to deal with, and I think they are going to fall to $20, give or take, in the next decade.
Well, another analyst, unfortunately, who recently passed away suddenly, but one of the top analysts in the area we had on the show somewhat regularly, Matthew Simmons, pointed out that when he visited the wells in the Middle East, they required the injection of massive amount of salt water to facilitate the removal of the remaining oil. And he said this is indicative of wells that will run dry in the next decade. So in other words, their reserves, in-ground reserves, were very, very low relative to some of the other newer. But let's move on now then to the precious metals. For the most part, gold still up over 5% for the year. I'd like your take on the prospects here. Are we still going to continue in this bear following the 2011 peak? Was it just too frothy at that point? Or do you see signs of a bottom here for gold and silver?
Well, you know, I do see gold prices and silver going down lower, same reasons as oil. It's just a general deflation in the global economy and a slowing. But, you know, it did get oversold around 1180 not too long ago, and it is bouncing. And gold's kind of a wild card because it's going to benefit from these geopolitical factors, but it's not going to benefit from the deflationary and slowdown forces. So I'm looking at gold probably rallying back to 1350, 1360 or so. Then I would call it a question mark. But it is a wild card because of geopolitical events. And so I don't think this is the time to be skeptical of gold. But I think as time goes on, if the economy does slow down as I forecast, then it will affect all commodities, not just gold.
Okay, well, I'd like to get into those geopolitical points in a moment. I'd also like to ask you this. When you talk about deflation, and we've discussed this many times in the past, I think we have to take a look at, you know, the ECB, for instance, which is still holding rates at the lowest level, just lowered it to the lowest point. Now, let's hearken back to the 1970s, you know, when rates were just incredibly low in the late 60s, early 70s. So you don't think this time we're going to go from a near zero or zero interest rate level into a similar 1970s period, just quite the opposite? You see almost a 1930s style or 1920s style deflationary environment. Can you contrast and compare the two and let us know how you see this unfolding?
Chris, I mean, one of the things we look at history is the economy for hundreds of years now has gone through a cycle. It used to be called a Kondratieff wave. But it's mild inflation boom and then a high inflation season, usually with wars like the 70s, and then disinflation and then a winter season with deflation. The economy's never gone any other direction. So we saw that, you know, spring boom in the 1950s and 60s. We saw the summer inflation that really was great for gold and silver and commodities in the 70s and early 80s. And then we've seen a disinflationary bubble boom, which always happens in the fall. But always following that bubble boom is a deflation, a restructuring of debt and financial assets that, yes, even though governments are printing money without abandon, the restructuring of such massive debt destroys money. Financial bubbles burst, which started to happen in 2008, and of course governments have reflated to fight that, always ends up in deflation. Unless this is the first time that doesn't happen, then that's our view, is that we're going to see deflation, and then you will see an inflationary environment again, but only after you've had that kind of reset. And again, it's the economy's never gone any other way. You don't go from a fall bubble boom season back to an inflationary summer season. You only go into deflation or winter.
Let's talk about Argentina, the Weimar Republic. Let's talk about Central Europe for a 50-year period following World War II, where governments just find no other option but printing massive amounts of money. And now it's much easier than it was in the past. Doesn't even require a printing press. What is going to keep our officials, our global central bankers, from pulling the same, you know, rabbit out of the hat, pumping up the system full of digital ones and zeros to keep the status quo, to keep the deflationary moment, a 1929-1931-32 style economic depression from unfolding? Don't you think that they'll follow the Keynesian model that they have now for nearly a century?
No, they will. And I've been surprised at how far they've gone in the last several years. But they're fighting demographic and debt trends that are far greater. I mean, the Fed is, you know, has created like $3 trillion in money. Well, that sounds like a lot, but compared to the size of the economy and compared to the total money supply, it's only a tiny fraction. So they can only impact so much. They have marginally kept us growing at 2%. With 1-2% inflation, with massive money printing. Now, if they had printed this much money in the 80s or the 70s or any other time when there were more inflationary trends, it would have been catastrophic. And Germany did this in the early 20s. You know, they lost World War One, and then they were saddled with reparations on top of that. They had to print massive amounts of money, but that's an isolated thing. Argentina and stuff. We've never seen major countries like Europe, you know, in the Europe or United States, be able to create hyperinflation simply from money printing. In fact, in the 1970s, the Fed was fighting inflation, as you said. It wasn't the Fed causing inflation. They were fighting it. It was the baby boom, you know, massive drain on the economy, a bunch of young people, you know, spending their parents' money, not producing anything, the lowest productivity in the last century. Had a lot to do with that inflation. In fact, I've got an indicator that predicts workforce growth and predicts when you'll see higher inflation with lots of young people or disinflation with older people. So aging not only affects our spending habits, it affects inflation. And the aging of the baby boom, they're just going to downsize houses, spend less, save more. This is not inflationary for the next decade. After, you know, the next generation will bring it back, but you know, that's another factor. So I don't see inflation coming back in mass, and it's certainly not. I mean, look at Europe. They've been stimulating for years. They got zero inflation. Japan's been stimulating for two decades almost. No inflation, zero. So if anybody says printing money has to cause inflation, then you got to look at reality and say, nope, not in this era.
But back to inflation, I agree with you at one level. I agree with you if we just look at the nominal statistics that the BLS and the government are throwing out there. But, you know, if we drill down into the actual inflation figures, if we compose our own indexes, you start to realize that the numbers just don't add up. I mean, that people are paying substantially more for everyday goods and services. And now, of course, you know, there's 300 million everyday Americans who can tell you that.
Well, I agree with Chris on that. Energy and food, yes. But look at housing. What's the biggest expenditure of the everyday household? It's housing. Mortgage rates are at record lows. Housing has fallen 20 to 30% from its peak, and I think it's going to go down further in the next few years. So housing is deflating, and it's huge. So overall, I think they don't really properly state inflation figures. They're understating some things, overstating others. But I think overall, we don't have major inflation, and again, despite unprecedented money printing. I mean, it's got to cause anybody to say, what's going on? Theory is they're inflating to fight deflation. So deflation is the bigger trend.
It's interesting, and there's definitely plenty of empirical evidence to support the idea. However, let's not ignore another component here that gets very little traction once again. Where is all the money that's been printed?
It's in the stock market. It's all gone into financial assets. In other words, we are getting inflation, but the money is going into financial assets because it has nowhere else to go. Bonds have been falling in value, commodities, even gold and silver of all things in a time like this. And so investors keep getting pushed into the stock market, and they're going to go over a huge cliff ahead. People are basically committing suicide by jumping into the stock market saying, well, where else am I going to get yield? Because everybody's doing the same thing. They're buying stocks. Our worst place to be right now. The Fed is giving them no choice. And I mean, you know, Janet, you know, I got criticized in my newsletter for making fun of Janet Yellen. I'm like, no. You think Wall Street's a bunch of Boy Scouts? You push interest rates to zero, hedge funds lever up 30 to 50 times and speculate like crazy, and then markets like oil in 2008, oil fell 82% in 4 months from speculation. And that's what the stock market is. It's just gone up, 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 up. Most of it's stock buybacks, low interest rates is not real. It's not real growth. The economy's not healthy. It's growing at only 2% on average with the most massive stimulus program in all of modern history. Something's wrong here, and people are piling into stocks.
It's an accident looking for a place to happen. Okay, we have a beautiful expression here on the left, but there's an equation. How do we balance this equation? Well, we need to know what will be the bull markets of the future to balance this out. Because obviously, there's going to be a huge global sea change shift in capital. The only thing that comes to my mind, at least the first thing, you know, the U.S. dollar. People are going to be clamoring for liquidity at some point if we start to talk about deflation. Tell us more.
Yeah. I mean, basically, if you look at the last crisis when things really melted down in late 2008, the U.S. dollar went up 27% versus other currencies because it is kind of the last hedge against a crisis. And I only see a crisis head. I don't see any other resolution. Governments are going to stimulate. They're in denial. People, investors and people are in denial. We're going to have a crisis to balance out this massive debt and massive financial bubbles. And once that happens, there will be huge, I mean, lifetime bargains in financial assets, from real estate to stocks to gold to commodity. I mean, it'll just, in fact, the next boom that we see starting about 6 to 10 years from now with the millennial generation and emerging countries, you know, their middle classes, this next boom will be very commodity intensive because it will be driven more by emerging countries. And they consume much more commodities. I mean, China and India are the biggest consumers of gold in the world. And India is going to have one of the greatest booms in history when we get on the other side of this. But you have to have this reset first. So I'm just telling investors, look, stand back, you know, either short stocks if you're brave or just be in cash and let the next crash happen and then look at the opportunities in like healthcare related industries in the U.S. and Europe and in emerging countries, particularly countries like India and Mexico that are not as sensitive to commodity prices. While that cycle is still down, and I mean, there will be huge opportunities for investment, but you got to let the crisis happen first. And there's no magic cure to this, especially now that governments have overstimulated. We're just going to have a huge crisis, and governments are going to fail. Despite they are going to keep stimulating, you're right about that. They're not going to stop doing this. They are tapering now. Just when the baby boomers are set to hit their next big demographic decline, and they're not aware of that. But it doesn't matter. China's going to blow, biggest bubble in the world. Germany is failing. We've been predicting this over the last year. Their statistics keep coming out weaker. They have the worst demographic trends of any single country over the next decade. And Europe is relying on Germany to hold up the European Union. Good luck. Super bullish because of the baby boom, and now the baby boom's done spending, and we've got this unbelievable debt bubble and financial bubble that the government's only making worse only sustaining. And when it fails, you look back at history, when debt bubbles and financial bubbles burst, it is always horrible. I mean, it's what happens. There's no good ending to a bubble like this.
What I hear is you need to avoid housing like the plague, because now that we've just blown another mini bubble, let's call it mini 2.0. So we've had quite a rebound over the past 3 or 4 or 5 years. And, you know, it looks tenuous in the HGX housing market index. I mean, we might end up back where we were, couldn't we, in the late, say, mid-90s in housing or even earlier.
That's what we're looking at, Chris, that bubbles go back to where they started or a little lower. And this bubble started in January of 2000, so I'm looking for real estate to go back at a minimum to January 2000 prices and at worst 1996 to 97 prices. That's another 40% down on average from here.
Well, that was my question. You know, can you put a percentage on it?
We're going to see a bigger decline than we saw the first time around. Same thing with stocks. Stocks, you know, crashed 50-some percent last time. I think they're going to crash 65% plus the next round.
Let's put stocks in abeyance for a moment, and let's just finish that thought. You know, you talk about up to a 40% decline. That's really quite a substantial statement. And remember the mountain of subprime, Alt-A, toxic loans we had to work our way through between 2006 and, let's say, 2012. Well, we've done that now. We've cleared most of that through the system. You're saying there's another specter here that we haven't prepared for?
Yeah, you know, it's just like the stock market. The Fed has, with super low interest rates, has caused a modest recovery in housing, which wouldn't have happened otherwise, because the baby boomers are done buying homes. They peaked, you know, back in the early, you know, mid-2000s on home buying. We predicted that in September 2005, that the bubble was peaking. People thought we were crazy. Housing can never go down. There's an endless, you know, demand against limited supply, and it went down. But it didn't. The Fed did not let housing shake out as much as it would have. They bailed it out, like they bailed everything out, and they bailed out stocks and got stocks to bubble again. So we have to have another round. We won't be over this bubble until stocks go back to early 2000 prices or before, and housing goes back to them. We have to reset the bubble. And nobody wants that to happen, because it's going to be painful for the banks, painful for investors, especially bondholders and stockholders and stuff and real estate owners and stuff. But it has to happen, because if we don't reset, the next generation is never going to be able to invest for retirement, never be able to afford a home. And so this is necessary, but it will be painful.
Well, it will be painful, but I think you make a really important point here, and that is, look, it's going to make prices more affordable. I mean, why are we fighting?
That's a good long-term thing. High real estate is only bad for an economy. It raises the cost of business, raises the cost of living. So the only people that want real estate to keep going up are the people that already own it, which is aging baby boomers. The young generation should be praying for home prices to come down, because they've yet to buy their homes.
Exactly. And if we look at Professor Shiller's work on the housing index going back roughly 100 years, it really shows what I think you'd agree to be, for the most part, a phenomenally stable trend. It's not even a trend. It's just almost like a horizontal asymptote.
Yeah. Actually, if you it goes housing long-term goes up with inflation, which has been on average 3%. Now it gets higher and lower, and it's lower now, and it was higher in the 70s. But it goes up with inflation. In other words, if you adjust for inflation, historically what Shiller has shown is that housing is not an appreciating asset. People shouldn't be buying housing for appreciation. They should buy it because they want to live in it. They should buy it because they want to rent it out to business or consumers. So we've got a huge misunderstanding of real estate, and Shiller did great work.
But, you know, I would argue that it's not a misunderstanding, that it's really a function of people intuitively recognizing, look, I've got to game the system to win here. They're learning my dollar doesn't hold its value. Purchasing power is evaporating. And so they're running to whatever might just, you know, make them enough money to keep things going. And obviously, this is going to be something that our officials are going to have to contend with in a big way in the years going forward. All right. Well, we've covered, I think, most of the bases. Why don't you tell folks more about the services you provide, please?
Yeah. We have a free daily newsletter at harrydent.com. It's called The Economy and Markets. And then at dentresearch.com, we have, you know, a whole wealth of information about all the newsletters and services that we provide. And this is a time to listen to somebody who's got a different opinion from my point of view. The normal economists are clueless on what's going on here.
Well, you definitely have a unique perspective that we don't run into from most of our guests here on GoldSeek.com Radio. Harry S. Dent Jr., we appreciate your thoughts.
Okay, thanks, Chris.